88.9 FM reminds you that the views expressed on WEAA programs are those of participants and not necessarily those of Morgan State University, the staff, management, or underwriters of Baltimore's home for cool jazz. WEAA 88.9 FM.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of a community. This morning, we start off with a national roundtable looking at the latest news and where we are headed, which we'll be doing a lot between now and January, maybe for the next 4 years, after we see how all this rolls out with this new Congress, Senate, and a new person in the White House. We're here with Mark Trahant, independent print and media journalist, who writes at TrahantReports.com, and of course, also past president of the Native American Journalists Association. Bill Fletcher, Jr., a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, editorial board member of BlackCommentator.com, co-author of the Indispensable Ally, Black Workers and the Formation of the CIO 1934-41, and Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and New Path Toward Social Justice, and Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities, and Obama 2.0, her latest work. And welcome, good to have all three of you with us.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talksteinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. But do join us if you can at 410-319-8888. So I just have to begin this way, and I just reflect on where we are headed and watching the shenanigans. No, they're not shenanigans. I shouldn't say that. Watching what's going on to New York and D.C., who's going to be Secretary of State, who's not going to be Secretary of State. But now the latest tweet out by the president-elect, everything was rigged, Bill Fletcher. It was all rigged, it's interesting to watch the media kind of try to normalize everything as if nothing is strange about this election.
Mark, what this starts to remind me of is when someone has a crazy uncle, and they say something, and people just look around and say, "Well, you know how Uncle such and such is." We have a situation that is both hilarious as well as incredibly scary. When Trump lashes out and claims that 3 million people voted illegally with no foundation, and you don't have a complete uproar. I mean, some of the media are finally saying, something about this, but there should be an uproar. I mean, 3 million, claiming 3 million people. But he continues to do this, and what happens is that this then feeds into these right-wing conspiracy sites, and it gets around, and you have, people believing this.
And Kimberly, I think that the frightening part is that is the case, that people really do believe this, that there is a rigged system. But nobody's really kind of talking about the real issues involved here, which is the 300,000 people in Wisconsin did not get a right to vote because many people were looking at that as being denied, right, because of a lack of ID and more. And yet with no evidence at all that anybody has voted illegally who is undocumented, though that's what's being purported. And these are kind of dangerous times when we think this is how we're beginning this process of the next 4 years.
Absolutely. And I would say even more so is I find it more interesting that it seems to be only rigged on one side. And so when the president-elect talks about what's rigged, I mean, before the election took place on November 8th, he talked about it being a rigged system. But then, of course, won, and all of a sudden that particular argument dissipated. And so we're now at the same spot all over again where there has to be an explanation for why he won the Electoral College vote but not the popular vote. And so it must be that the system is rigged. But there's no conversation about if it is, in fact, is rigged, then why is it not possible for it to be rigged in a way that would benefit Hillary Clinton and not Donald Trump?
And Mark Trahant, I think that the way this is playing out, I mean, there's just so much here to kind of wrestle with. I mean, we looked at what's going on in Standing Rock, which we'll be talking about in the second half an hour of the program, and more with more focus. But clearly, the people who own the pipeline company and others were salivating at the chances that that when Trump becomes president, and how that will heighten their interest. I'm curious how that works out there as well.
Well, it's not even their interest. Forbes and the Associated Press is reporting that President-elect Trump is an investor in the Dakota Access Pipeline and the related companies, and has a direct, what normally in federal circles would be a conflict of interest, but in Trump world is just another part of doing business as president. You know, there's one other part of this whole voting thing that I think somehow we get so fixated on the Electoral College and its unfairness, and we forget that we have some really structural weaknesses in democracy that the rest of the world recognizes that we don't. And one of them is the United States Senate. When a supermajority in the United States Senate can determine, can get elected from 570,000 people in Wyoming, whereas it takes 33 million in California. That imbalance is actually one of the greatest in all of electoral politics.
So if you take this and you add to it, the news that people have been talking about a great deal, at least the New York Times and other journals have over the last few days, which is the potential conflict of interest, that, you know, when you look at the Article 1 of the Constitution says, Section 9 of the Constitution bars office holders from accepting any present annulment, office or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state, and to limit the foreign influence over presidents. Whether this has any bearing on all the interests of Trump enterprises around the globe, the New York Times outlined in some detail over the weekend Trump's investments and negotiations with political people and others in India, the Philippines, countries around the world. And I think, Bill Fletcher, this is something I think if I was a betting man, I would bet that this is not going to affect his presidency. It's just going to keep rolling.
You know, I've been wondering about that, Mark. I mean, one of the possibilities is that this really will be a short-lived presidency, and that that he will be impeached. Because here's the problem for the Republicans. They're on the verge of discrediting the presidency as an institution, if they haven't already. And the question of whether these conflicts of interest will be sustained really then raises this question of the legitimacy of the presidency of the United States. And so the Republicans have to decide. They will ultimately have to decide, and the Democrats first, actually, because they'd have to move this, whether or not they can risk continuing this Trump presidency. Now, if it continues, one of the things that has to be looked at, and it will be, what do the Trump voters say about this, and what does this actually tell us about what people were thinking on November 8th? Because I actually believe that November 8th had much less to do with economics than many other people, and we've discussed this before, and that it had much more to do with the fear of the future on multiple levels, and that Trump was the means to save white people from the future. And I think that a lot of people will, in fact, say at the end of the day that it's okay to have a corrupt president.
Mark?
Yeah, I think that's it. One of the areas that I think is going to be really interesting, and it's actually going to happen in the next couple of weeks, is the divide from people who thought that Trump would benefit them. And you see that play out with agricultural interests that thought everything would be fine for their interests, yet oil's going to dominate. And so he's going to choose between the current regulations on additives from agricultural products or shift to all oil. And either way, one constituency is really going to be ticked off. Same thing with ranchers who thought that it would improve trade prospects when, in fact, the language that's coming out of the future White House is more about trade wars rather than trade expansion. And so people that took all this into account thinking, yeah, this guy's going to bring new prosperity, I think are going to be sorely disappointed. And then all they've got to turn back to is the race issue. And that demographics is a much more powerful force than any president of the United States.
What do you mean a much more powerful force than president of the United States?
If you look in any classroom, almost anywhere in America, you see what the country is going to look like in 10 years. And it's not the country they're trying to protect.
Hmm. What was that from Kimberly? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with most of the points that have been raised, other than I'm not as confident that a Republican-controlled Congress will actually take steps to advance impeachment. I think folks are reveling in the space that they currently occupy and believe that there's so much grand opportunity for them and the conservative values or perspectives of government that I'm not sure if they're willing to take the steps necessary to protect the presidency in the way that they should. And I think we see early examples of that already, where so many of the very candidates that were running against Trump and those who were vocal against him along the campaign are now kind of turning on their heels and seemingly joining the ranks of the Trump presidency and wanting to align themselves with who he is. And I do think that raises other questions in terms of, you know, people's politics and their willingness to do such and not stand behind the very rhetoric and values that they say they represent. But I think all of this for us is so brand new because, of course, the Trump candidacy and now soon-to-be presidency was so unorthodox for all of us anyway. So I'm not as I do think it will set a very bad precedent if we allow so much of what has taken place even now to continue. But I'm not sure that Republicans are going to come from behind that curtain and say enough is enough. This is unacceptable. That the conflicts of interest raise a problem. That you know, where you live and where your family lives is a problem. Like, all of those pieces of this process are so unorthodox for us that we don't know exactly how to respond, but we need to respond because, in fact, it will set a horrendous precedent for what the future of the presidency looks like in America.
I can't remember a time in recent history or in American history, there have been times, but when things have been so potentially turbulent, Bill Fletcher, as we have now. I mean, I think from all kinds of levels. I mean, because you've got this kind of weird mix of a popular sentiment that goes from right to left in America that had problems with the powerful elites and TPP and NAFTA and the rest, and then you've got this all the other issues intertwined here. I mean, the sending the right to choose back to the states, which could very well happen, which could lead to more illegal underground abortions and a whole another movement starting in America that died after Roe v. Wade in the early 70s. I mean, there's a lot here that could just be extremely explosive, not to mention the demonstrations that people plan for Inauguration Day and demonstrations that may continue around the country and what this all might portend. And Democrats themselves kind of upside down with people not wanting Ellison. Some saying he's that's the push saying that Congressman Ellison is anti-Semitic because he supported Farrakhan at some point when he was a kid. And there's a huge turbulence here with this election. Everybody's confused. The establishment's in a total uproar.
We're in a crisis. There's no question about it. But I just want to remind you that the U.S. has gone through many significant political crises since 1783. And, you know, whether you're talking about corruption scandals during the Grant administration, whether you're talking about Watergate, etc., you talk about the turbulence of the 50s and 60s. And so it's easy to forget that those things actually happened. And, you know, remember, Richard Nixon thought we were on the verge of a civil war in the early 1970s. So it's a cautionary note. Now, that said, we're absolutely in a moment of crisis. And what makes, I think, the current situation different is that it's in a global context, where we have a global economic crisis and a global environmental crisis, and these things are happening when people are losing faith in the various institutions And so what the Trump administration does, ironically, having campaigned theoretically from the outside, is that it further discredits the institutions. And this is where my worry about the extreme right comes in. Because when in a situation one looks at a complete discrediting of all of the institutions, that can be an opening for the left or it can be an opening for the right. And many of Trump's supporters who have gravitated towards neo-fascism and secessionism may decide that this is an administration that has not gone far enough. Now, just one other quick thing just about this impeachment thing.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to happen. I don't know. But here's the thing to keep in mind. The Republicans lose nothing if they impeach Trump. They gain Pence. And that's the thing that we have to keep in mind. It's not like an impeachment would lead to another election. They could get rid of him. He's unreliable as far as the establishment is concerned. And what they get is a stable reactionary in the form of Pence.
Pence. No, I think that is, I think, many people's biggest fear, especially on the progressive liberal end of the spectrum, Kimberly, is that people actually, when he nominated Pence as his vice president, feared Pence and what he may bring to the table even more than Trump himself, because he's such a hardcore ideologue when it comes to so many issues.
Yeah, I think that is the concern for a number of people, and because of the inflammatory nature of President-elect Trump, that has been something shrouded behind that curtain that we're not paying as much attention to, because we don't foresee that impeachment actually taking place. But the reality is that Pence should be someone we are concerned about, because he will be very comfortable in believing that the mandate of this election has given him access to exactly what the conservative perspective is on many of these issues, not just in terms of, you know, smaller government, but and then being more pro-corporate America, but certainly in terms of the cultural politics that we are dealing with in this country, and how we will see an erosion of so much of what has been gained in terms of traction for various groups of people in this country, that Pence will, in fact, work very diligently to erode away those opportunities.
So, I mean, in some ways, you know, when you think about this, Mark Trahan, the what we're seeing is this kind of redefining of who America is and what America means. Ever since the article by Mark Lilla, again in the New York Times, on the opinion piece last Sunday, I think it was, The End of Identity Liberalism, he wrote about where the Democrats made a mistake, he thought. It's raised the question of that I think America really is wrestling with in this election, and overall, is what does the we mean?
Right?
What does we mean? We the people. Who are the we?
I was at a session with some futurists in Silicon Valley in September, and one of their observations, and this is way before anyone voted, is the democracies reach a point of 300, 350 million where it becomes impossible to govern. And at that point, then you start wondering, like a showman building a stage and just playing on that rather than actually governing. One of the, I think, problems that Trump is going to face almost immediately is competence. Appointing people to offices that just have no ability to handle a federal bureaucracy, which is not an easy task. And I think you're going to see that play out where they want to do something. And one of the things that all presidents discover is how little power they have in some regard, because the rules are so complex that if you can't figure them out and how to maneuver with them, often you'll make a decision and not have it executed. And that could be a good thing for the country over the next 4 years.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that is one of the short-sighted points of Trump and his campaign, is because he is such a I guess, seen as very successful in the business world, that he is a no-holds-barred type of guy that's going to come in and clean up and drain the swamp and make things better and run more efficiently like some of his businesses have, when the reality is, you know, this is, you know, in the academic world, it's synonymous to shared governance, that the reality is nothing is moving unless all people are on the same page and believe that this is something that we need to support. And so his idea of draining the swamp sounds very much like a corporate, this sounds more like corporate rhetoric, where he's able to just walk in and say, I need to get rid of these people because they are not fulfilling what we need to see happen in order for this business to be successful. And that is just not how government works. And there are way too many people at the table who matter in decision making that I think he will learn very quickly that it won't move as quickly as he would like it to. And I think that will be probably one of his limitations, is being able to withstand that very point.
But go ahead, Bill.
You know, Mark, the thing about it is, this is such a weird situation. There's this movie that Humphrey Bogart did in 1941 where he infiltrates a band of Nazis who are planning a terrorist attack on New York City. And he and his partner are pretending to be saboteurs, and they are questioned by the Nazis about what they're doing. And they start talking gibberish. And at the point that people are beginning to wonder who these people are, Humphrey Bogart stands up and says, Sieg Heil, and everybody else stands up and says, Sieg Heil, and that settles the matter. That's what I worry about here, that all of these things that we as rational people are pointing to that could trip up this administration could get flipped the moment that they yell Sieg Heil, the moment that they decide to go and start registering Muslims, the moment they decide to start deporting Latinos, and pointing the finger at these various groups and saying, the reason I'm not able to do this is because of, and then fill in the blank. And that's why we cannot sit back and expect that this becomes a train wreck. We have to be, as progressives, out there talking and organizing people to make sure that this administration cannot succeed in its reactionary agenda.
And the frightening part is, though, Mark, that in picking up from there, let's go to the phones here for a call before you have to go to break, is that it really could succeed, this agenda of his.
It certainly could. Every democracy is fragile, and this one's no different.
Let me hit the phones at 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning.
This question, no one can really identify what the crisis really is. The crisis for the people sitting in the audience is different from the crisis in the people from behind the stage. So what is the crisis? Is the crisis reinvestment in America, bringing all that money from overseas and offshore bank accounts back? Do we have one fraction who wants to destroy the empire for the sake of the country, and the other fraction wants to destroy the country for the sake of the empire? So correctly identify what the crisis is. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I think in some ways, Mark Trahan, I mean, the crisis is there's so many crises at one time here.
Right.
You know?
I think Bill's point early on about the country and the changes going through and the smaller population that's been ruling for two centuries plus wants to keep that in place. And as the country changes, that's just not going to be possible. And so that push back and forth is something, and that's happened before in history, and it gets settled, but it's a tough question when you're going through it.
Let me get some final thoughts here from our other two guests, Bill Fletcher, and then go to Kimberly.
The crisis is whether humanity can make it out of the 21st century. The crisis is whether or not we can have an economy that actually serves people as opposed to serves corporations. The crisis is whether there can be a transition in the demographics of this country, and a peaceful transition in the demographics of this country, or whether or not we're going to have a neo-apartheid state. The crisis is whether there will be a rethinking of the attitude of law enforcement. I mean, the crisis exists on a number of different levels, and it's the coming together, sort of like the plates underneath the earth coming together, that's creating this kind of earthquake.
Kimberly?
I think for me the crisis is that we have bought into, and we meaning voters, American voters, have bought into this position of lack, that there are very few places at the table, and we have to vie and fight for one of those places at the table. And if that means I need to marginalize, ostracize, and vilify other groups of people to remove them from the table so that I have a seat at the table, I'm willing to do so. And for me, I think that in itself is a problem in terms of why we find so much of the angst and anxiety around a Trump presidency, because he, in fact, stoked those fires and made people feel like that's exactly what the problem was, that you too can be as successful as I am, as Donald Trump, if it wasn't for a number of other factors that prevent you from gaining access to that. Now, that's a whole other show to talk about capitalism,
right,
and how that works.
Right.
And why that does not exist and why that is not possible, but at least in the sense of the rhetoric that we buy into of America as, you know, this place of exceptionalism and this opportunity for us to just simply work hard and you too can have, really buys into what Trump fed so many of us as voters, and we responded to it by saying, yes, let me just get rid of these folks and I then can have exactly what Trump has, which is so naive of all of us.
So as we go to break here and move to see the latest in Standing Rock, which we'll be covering every day for a bit on this program as we wind to this date that the federal government has given to take out the encampment. I'm very curious, very quickly, Bill Fletcher, let me start with you and go around the table real fast. What do you think the future holds then for the Democratic Party, for those who are in opposition to Trump, to most of America that did not vote for him? What do you think the next steps are? It has to something be beyond people just marching in the streets.
Agree. I think that there fundamentally needs to be a refounding of the Democratic Party. And I think that there's elements of that are in place right now as a result of the Sanders campaign and these little insurrections that are beginning to take place in around the United States with different electoral organizations. So I think that will be fundamental, and that also, you know, who becomes the head? Does Keith Ellison become the chair
right.
of the DNC? So I think that there's some interesting possibilities.
And that's an if now. We thought it was going to be right. It was a given, but now it is an if. It's a huge if. Mark, quick closing thought from you, and then Kimberly, and we'll go to our break.
I think the Democratic Party has to become a coalition again, not just a single entity as a party, because I think our ideas about the world are becoming more and more diverse, and we'll have this structure where we can't govern with one or two parties in a system. We need to have multiple parties, but we're not set up to do that. So the Democrats can respond by being more inclusive as a coalition, bringing lots of points of view in, and then in the end coming together somehow.
And Dr. Moffitt, I want you to give us a closing thought.
Yeah, I would say that right now where we are, both parties are being redefined. I don't think it's unique or specific to the Democratic Party. I mean, I think this particular election revealed for many that there has to be a shift in both of these parties, because people do, as American voters, do feel disaffected and not included in the political process. And so, yes, there is a shifting that's taken place, and I think it's happening in both parties, because I would say some conservatives are looking and saying, I don't recognize my party. And I would say Democrats are saying, what are we not doing that we can't rally more support behind our party? But if I'm focusing on the Democratic Party, I would say I do think, as embracive as we are and inclusive as we are as a as that particular party for various segments of our society, that I think what this election showed us is that identity politics is not the only issue that can be at play for Democrats, that there have to be other issues that help to rally people around believing that this is a party speaking for, you know, particular values, that identity politics is certainly a part of, but it shouldn't be the sole foundation of.
I want to thank you all. This Bill Fletcher, it's always great to have you on the program with us. We look forward to you coming back more and more here as we look at where this nation is going. I think your voice is critically important to that. Thank you so much for taking your time today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have to take a very short break. When we come back, we are going to talk about what's happening in Standing Rock. Mark Trahan stays with us for that. The Emily Moffitt is remaining as well. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Do not go away.
President Obama.
There are so many broken promises that you've made. We can hear you, but can you hear us?
Remember that you have the power to make a change, a huge, huge change.
And I'm here to remind you that you stood for us.
Where are you?
Do our children not matter?
Everything that's happening here has happened before. We remember. Just like the African American community remembers slavery, we remember colonization, and we're not gonna forget.
I'm calling you out now to stop this pipeline because it's the right thing to do.
You need to come stand with us right here on this land. You need to come stand with us and be with us so that you know what is happening.
You're not only doing it for us, you're doing it for everyone.
We're not going to forget the word that you gave us.
We're not going to be the generation that stops fighting.
It's time to honor your word.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We will be looking at Standing Rock all this week, starting today and every day, as we will the passing of Fidel Castro. We'll be having commentaries on that as well all week long from many different sources and people. We are going to go back to our guests now who are with us, Mark Trahan, independent print and media journalist, professor at University of North Dakota in journalism, writes at TrahanReports.com, and of course, past president of the Native American Journalists Association. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt remains with us as well, associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Blackberries and Red Bones, critical articulations of Black Hair Body Politics in Africana Communities, and her latest Obama 2.0 that she put, that was a book and a conference. And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888. Please do join us with your thoughts and ideas, or write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. So Mark Trahan, we played this piece at the top, and we're waiting for Susan Harjo to call in as well in just a minute. Because news changed over the last couple of days. And now, you know, people thought that President Barack Obama was going to make some stand to with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to block the pipeline before the next administration is in office. But the opposite seems to be happening.
Well, the development was that the Army Corps of Engineers said that after December 5th, folks will be considered trespassers. And it's interesting, both sides have actually kind of discounted that. The sheriffs and the county in Morton County, North Dakota, have said that's fine, but if the federal government's not willing to enforce it, it doesn't mean anything. And Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairman Dave Archambault II has said that he didn't think it was a big deal. He thought it was more about liability issues, that the Army Corps didn't want to have people on the land with a permit, and they couldn't grant a permit, so they took this step. So it remains to be seen how that plays out. I still think there's room for the president to maneuver, and one thing that the voices from Standing Rock just doesn't get is how complicated it is for the president. He really has to find a legal finding to make it so, and one that will hold up now with an incoming administration. I still think what that would be basing on the executive order on consultation, and the president can find that the Army Corps did not properly consult with the tribe and tie it up so that it's at least a several-month process to undo it. And that's kind of, to me, the best hope scenario. There's another one, though, that I want to write about this week, and that is in this treaty that the Standing Rock Sioux tribe signed, the Fort Laramie Treaty, it was there's provisions in there for infrastructure for railroads, and it was kind of the beginning of manifest destiny. And it actually allows for a treaty commission, a three-member independent treaty commission, to look at some of these complex issues and come up with a finding. And that would be a brilliant move, is to actually rely on the treaty itself as a source of where we go from here.
But the question is whether I think, Kimberly, whether the White House has the ability to do that, or has the gumption to do that politically.
Yeah, and I think I agree that with Mark that it is a very tenuous space in which the president is in at this time to be able to find the grounds in which to do so. I remember reading another one of these so-called leaked articles on Twitter yesterday that said that the president had, you know, made a determination that he was forcibly removing everyone. And I thought, wow, okay, that's a bit different than what I would anticipate from his leadership. But is it because he has no other grounds? And so based on what we are, what is now coming out, we do have a clearer sense of where some of this language is being given to us. But I also believe that his hands are tied, but he is looking for those ways in which to address this issue, which will allow us to have more time to figure out what needs to be done, because something does need to be done.
So, I you know, when you look at the possibility that on the 5th of December that police forces and the federal government now may force people off of the site where they are encamped, which is being claimed is owned by the Army Corps of Engineers and being used for hanging and cattle and whatever else. Mark, you've been in and out of there, and I've been talking to folks all weekend long who are there at this moment. I mean, things are pretty tense. And if that would happen, that would I wonder what the result of that would be beyond the move by the government itself.
I don't think the current government has the resources to do that mass eviction. One of the things that's happening before December 5th that I think will just, again, elevate this discourse is veterans from across the country are going to Standing Rock. And there's all kinds of folks that have talked about going. And if that increases the number of people by nth degree to 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, it makes it much more complicated for the government, whether it be the state government or the county or even the federal government, to act. I don't see how they do it without troops, and there's no legal status to use troops.
Why can't they just use the police to come in and just force people out?
Yeah, if you have enough police, but when there's 8,000 people there, that's problematic.
Kimberly, as somebody who is lives here on the East Coast, not from the Native community, I'm curious what your thoughts, and I want to hear our listeners' thoughts at this at 410-319-8888, is the importance of what's happening right now in Standing Rock.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's not a part of my lived experience, but it's certainly a part of my understanding of what it means to fight for what you believe is legally yours, but also very much a part of how you see yourself as a person of color in this country. And so I wholeheartedly support what I see happening at Standing Rock. And, you know, I remember reading a piece this morning on CNN that talked about, you know, tribe members saying, we're in this for the long haul. And I think that piece is very telling, is to recognize that, you know, when we're talking about social justice and progress, that it's not something short-term, that we just show up and we protest and it's done, but recognizing that if this is something at the core of how you see yourself and what you believe in, that there's a need for there to be this long-standing tradition of being able to carry out what it is that you stand for instead of simply making the news temporarily and then disappearing when it doesn't work out your way.
You know, again, Mark, when you every time I see what's happening here, and one of the things we heard this morning was that people at the camp itself were kind of getting frustrated with the numbers of people coming in who don't know why they're there other than to look, and people coming in unprepared for the cold of North Dakota, which I think is a reality as well.
Right.
You know, but I just, so you can talk a bit about that, but I'm also very curious about what the long-term effect of this might be.
Well, and the weather, it snowed there this morning, and so it actually made it really beautiful. One of the organizers was talking about having sled runs on Media Hill. It should be quite a day ahead. I think long-term, I mean, this is something that is one of those unique moments in history. You look at the 2.5 centuries of conflict and everything else with the federal government and tribes, and never before in history has everybody come together on one issue. And what's extraordinary about it is you have tribes that are energy resource tribes that have internally said, you know what, we should look at our own practices. You have tribes that don't have resources that are sending people there You're having tribes with resources financially sending either lots of contributions or supplies, or just this bringing together of people is an extraordinary moment that I don't think will slowly dissipate.
So, you know, when you look at the larger picture of change in America and where these next 4 years are going, and that you look at, I mean, Native people in America are what, is it 1% of the population? Is that
right?
Right. But the focus, I think, because A, of our history in this country, B, because of the massive protests that are taking place at Standing Rock, the connections being made between the folks at Standing Rock and other movements around the country, it's interesting to watch what a profound effect this is having beyond those numbers.
Absolutely.
Right?
And I think that's the real strength. And it feeds into so many other areas. For example, as we talk about what the United States and the globe can do about climate change, indigenous people throughout the world, but clearly in this part of the world, have a 10,000-year history. And they've gone through droughts, they've gone through massive changes in the land, and have a way of understanding it that's just different. And I think those conversations, I mean, when you think about even pressure from the United States, it's only 200, 300 years old compared to 10,000 years. There's a longer view that I think allows folks to think there's a way out of this.
You know, Mark, what I find interesting, and of course this is coming from my media studies lens of how we are handling this situation versus the Bundy situation, where both was
right.
about groups claiming to stand ground and say, you know, enough already. But I think, again, because of the role of capitalism that's very much at the heart of what is happening with the Dakota Access Pipeline, that it makes it almost, it's willing to push aside what the tribes are arguing for, because the reality is, what does this bring us? And for a particular corporation, for several hundred people who will work, I mean, that seems to be something we want to rally around as a nation, regardless of what it means about climate, regardless of what it means about what is considered sacred land, that we're willing to just completely disregard those elements, all for the sake of what this will actually bring to the country in terms of financial wealth.
Right. That's always been true. When the Fort Laramie Treaty was signed, the pipeline companies were railroads, and they were basically doing the same kinds of things. It's kind of an interesting twist, is right when you enter Morton County coming from the west, you switch time zones. And North Dakota has this weird blob of time zones where part of the state is mountain, part of the state is central. And you think, how could a government ever come up with such a goofy plan where Williston, which is in the far west, is on central time zone, and Killdeer in the center of the state, western side of the state, is on mountain time zone. And it's because the railroads wanted it that way. It has nothing to do with governance. So this power of the corporate, the ceding of governance to corporations, is something that's a part of this region's history for a long time.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888, as we look at what's going on at Standing Rock in this half hour of the Mark Steiner Show, and we'll be looking almost daily at what's happening in North Dakota. Anita in Laurel, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Anita.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
My question is, when will these people have enough? When will they be satisfied? I don't think that there's any satisfaction for the rich who, no matter how much they have, it's just greed. And I mean, you discovered someone else's home, taken it, and you're still not satisfied. That's it. That's all I have to say.
Anita, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Mark?
I can't agree more. Wise words. just looking at the folks there, and I mean, right in the Constitution, treaties are the supreme law of the land, and yet you have the Constitution or the sheriff saying, well, these Native Americans should be respecting the rule of law. And those two things don't track.
And they don't, you know, Kimberly, I mean, you know, when you look at what's happening with movements in the black community now and the kind of general deep concern about Trump becoming president of the United States by many people in the black community, other communities of color, especially immigrant communities. I mean, what does Standing Rock say to you in that context?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what fortifies me to believe that, you know, these are the types of movements that we have to stay firmly behind and support, recognizing that, again, it's about the long haul, and it cannot be something that is seen as, you know, titillating because it's all over social media and that, you know, mainstream media is covering it, so we should be behind it and supporting it temporarily. But, again, that it has a long haul. And, I mean, and Mark, you yourself, as someone who was very much involved in the civil rights movement, can attend to this, that it was not something of you going out protesting for a few days and change miraculously happened, that this is a process that requires folks to be committed to a cause that will need body after body to support for a long period of time, instead of believing that it's just on the news cycle for a few days or even a few months and then all is well, because otherwise the status quo remains. And so it's so important for our individuals to recognize that you've got to be in this and for the long haul, and to recognize that this is not a short-term movement.
You know, I think that's a big piece of this to me, Mark Trahan, when you look at this, is that I'm curious, you know, what we think the effect this might have on the Native movement in America. This has been the largest gathering ever, really, of people coming in from across the country, constantly going back and forth between their homelands and their cities and back again. And what it might also say about building movements on Native land itself. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people who would argue that a lot of tribal governments are very colonial governments. Not all, but many are. And what effect this might have on just the growth of Native movements across the country.
Yeah, I think it's bringing about, and I agree that it's the long haul, and it's bringing about a new sense of both respect not just for each other, but for the planet, Mother Earth, and our idea about how we're going to get to a sustainable future. I mentioned this before, but to me, one of the most hopeful signs is some of the tribes that have been deeply involved in energy development are starting to take a look and say, wait a minute, this is not going to be our future. We've got to start looking for alternatives. It can't just be about money. And I think that is a long-term prospect that changes people. And when you start changing people, then you can change institutions.
Folks, do join us, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts about where this takes us, what's going on in Standing Rock, how it feeds into the great political changes in America and the forces that are dynamically opposed, it feels like, in America, and where that takes us. 410-319-8888. You can email us at talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. And I will look at those Facebook pages now as we people have been writing all weekend to me about what's happening in Standing Rock as we have been sharing things on Facebook as well. 410-319-8888. I'm very curious, since we have you on the phone here from UMBC right now, Kimberly, if there's much talk about this on campus.
No, I don't think I hear students or even those that consider themselves progressives on campus having the conversation specifically about Standing Rock. I think the attention grabber right now is very much about President-elect Trump and, you know, some of the rhetoric, fiery rhetoric that he used during his campaign, and then, of course, some of his recent appointments for his cabinet that have raised questions for students and certainly draw attention to concerns around, of course, immigration, conversations about, you know, campus sanctuary. Those are the things that I hear students talking mostly about.
So, and Mark, you seem, from what we talked about earlier, not to be as concerned about the date of December the 5th of actually pushing people out. The other folks who have been writing in Indian Country Today, Jenny Monet and others who are going to be on the show later in the week, seem to be really concerned that this could actually happen.
Well, I think the sheriff definitely could use it as an excuse. And I think, to me, the primary danger is they'll start trying to pick people off. So if somebody's a little bit farther from camp, where they can get one or two or three or four. And one of the things you saw in some of the early actions is they would try to separate people, and those would be the ones first arrested. But I'm not sure the state of North Dakota could arrest 9,000 people and have the facilities, the court action, all of that to be able to process that many people without the help from the federal government. And I just don't think the federal government, at least until January 20th, is going to play along.
Yeah, I would agree with that point, but I also think, again, you know, that entity of life now, social media, that can be a blessing and a curse, will work against the government, at least for now, where to actually capture images of people being forcibly removed off of the land can really spark an outrage across the nation, and I'm not certain that that's the direction that folks want to see it go, and certainly we may see something different after January 20th, but at least where we are right now, I think it would create quite a bit of an uproar.
You know, and we'll see what happens after January the 20th. I mean, I think that the real danger here is, of course, that what's clear is that the companies like the ones that control this pipeline are actually salivating for that moment because they think things can change drastically at that point. I mean, really drastically.
Yeah.
I mean, because...
Well, having your stockholder as president-elect is not a bad thing, I guess.
Not at all.
Because, you know, following this and watching people on the ground here, I think, Mark, you've been there. And just before we have to go, give a sense for our listeners, the sense of community that's been built there. Because to me, everybody I've talked to who's lived there and has been there, it's really amazing.
You know, even just saying those words, I get chills. It really is one of the most awe-inspiring things I've ever encountered. And the sense of purpose, the sense of peace, the sense of mission, all those three things come together, sense of tradition and culture. When somebody pulls, walks toward the Dakota Access security or the sheriff and pull out a drum as their weapon of choice and a song, I just think that is unbelievably powerful.
I think that because these are one of these moments people don't realize are kind of life-changing, not just for the nation watching, but really especially for the people who are in the midst of these demonstrations, in the midst of the encampment, what it does for them, what it's done for the I mean, everywhere you turn, you know, it's like when you look at what happens with Trump, and the first words we heard in the show were from the black community and people's fear in the immigrant community and the people's fear of what would happen with Trump being elected. What you're seeing here, though, is something very different, which is that the overwhelming power and sense of power that it's given Native communities across America.
Well, I think for me, I would say it's given voice to a segment of our population that many have pretended didn't exist or certainly didn't play a significant role, because we don't see Native Americans in this country as a political entity that does make a difference in elections or can influence elections. And so it allows so many to, especially those holding political power, to pretend or ignore a very significant segment of our population in this country. And I think this particular movement is showing that it is not just about Native people, but it is about a larger community that says enough already, and we're willing to take a stand to support and fight back, or at least resist what capitalist notions. I'm sounding so much like a Marxist this morning. and not intentional, but it certainly sounds that way, that I'm very concerned about our willingness to, placate to corporate interests at the expense of populations who really take seriously the notion of what land means, what climate and energy issues mean in this country, and to ignore that as though it doesn't matter simply because someone can make money off of it is quite problematic.
Well, it's always wonderful having you both on the show here, Bill. Mark Trahan, thank you so much once again for joining us. Always great to have you with us. I look forward to many more conversations with you. Dr. Kimmy Moffitt, thanks so much for being able to join us as well. I look forward to having you back in the studio soon.
Thank you.
Thank you all both. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we'll take a look at what's happening in Baltimore. Don't go away.